Last time we talked about some issues that I do not think really concern us, our science and religion, some phony issues. Today, I'd like to talk about some places where I think science causes us to have some second reflections and to think a little bit. I won't be attacking science per se, but I'll be asking us to treat science a little with more humility than we have been treating her. So first of all, let us begin with some characteristics of science that are on the board, namely four aspects of scientific thought that we will be talking about. There are many other aspects one could mention. I would just be mentioning four. The first one, science is a way of organizing data so we can understand the world we live in and predict both future events, like when a volcano will erupt, and the effects of our actions, such what will happen if we burn high sulfur content coal, namely acid rain and Ted Lakes. Science then attempts to describe how things work. It does not try to prescribe, merely describe. It doesn't say how things ought to be. For example, we can get some data that the people in the United States, 6% of the world's population, use between 30 and 35% of the energy. Now, that doesn't mean that we ought to use that much energy. Similarly, we can find out that 25% of the children in Bolivia and Zambia die before their first birthday. Again, that doesn't mean they ought to die before their first birthday. Sexism and racism, we can say, is common to all cultures. Yet that doesn't mean it ought to be common to all cultures. Yet it's easy to slip into that. You know, you get the kind of argument, all cultures have had women subordinate to men. It's hard generalization to prove, but then the people say, therefore, women ought to be subordinate. So science cannot write us a moral textbook. It can't tell us what we ought to do. It can correct our moral reasoning or influence our moral reasoning in some ways. For example, I could have a moral principle founded on false beliefs about reality. For example, I might decide that that it would be immoral to have gay people which have a homosexual preference, teach grade school or nursery school because I believe that they're going to molest children. Now, if I get scientific data, and it does exist, this shows me that a greater percentage of heterosexuals molest children than homosexuals. That might cause me to change my moral reason, my principle. But nevertheless, science cannot prescribe what we ought to do. So morals is outside the realm of science. Second characteristics. Scientists or theories are ideally to be subject to empirical testing. We ought to be able to do some kind of factual test to show whether the theory applies or not. So ideally, science limits itself to qualities which can be measured empirically. Now, philosophers like to call this verifiability or falsifiability, some fancy words, which I think are equally misleading. So I'll just call it testability. We ought to be able to test it and see if it applies. Thus, science likes qualities which can be measured. Temperature. Science likes to, temperature, that's a nice one because we can tell if something's hotter or colder and compare it to a scale. Or color. We can tell if something's lighter or darker. We wouldn't want to use our eyes, but we can measure light waves. Speed, whether something's faster or slower. Now, scientists take this very, very seriously. You all heard of Albert Einstein and know that he formulated his theory of relativity. Now, one aspect of that theory states simply that if you would blast me out in space and compared to you, I start moving very, very fast, perhaps close, approaching the speed of light, an impossibility, but this is a mind game, you would look at me and you would see my watch moving very slowly compared to yours, my heart beating slowly compared to yours. So it's a fantastic theory. And now much of modern physics is based on it. However, many physicists, after it was first published, considered it mathematical because there was no way of testing it. They couldn't conceive of how to test it. Later, when they found ways how to test it, it became a scientific theory. So science tries to limit itself to those aspects of reality, those concepts that can be tested. Scientists then like to deal with things such as brain waves. That's a nice concept, brain waves, because we can measure it on electroencephalogram and get these nice measurable qualities. They don't like to deal with emotions like anger, joy, or despair. They're not measurable. They can't be quantified. They're too subjective. So the second one is science. Scientific theories are subject to, leave that out? Oh, are subject to empirical testing. Are subject to empirical testing, and instead of scientific creativity, we should have had there. It strives to be objective and unambiguous. I had to do it quickly to get there in time for my TISH team. Now, one of my favorite television shows is Nova. Do any of you ever watch Nova? And one of them had it on TM, and scientists were trying to see what TM, Transcendental Meditation, did. And they could measure some brainwave changes. And that was really interesting. The brainwave changes were about the same they could measure when somebody did the relaxation response. But they admitted that they couldn't measure any of the other claims that the TM advocates made. They couldn't say anything about whether they had the kind of integrative whole experience that they purported. That was outside the realm of science. So much is outside the realm of science. Some of those are listed. Science can't make theological claims. Those can't be tested empirically. Poetry strives on ambiguity, right? That's the thing of poetry. Science can't judge that, artistic expression or existential knowledge. So science is good for only those things which can be measurable. That's why we have more confidence in the hard sciences, physics and chemistry, than in social sciences. Because social sciences are often dealing with things which are hard to measure. Third, now that one's correct, I think. Well, scientific theories and laws transcend the data. They don't merely report the data. Take Sir Isaac Newton. He wouldn't have been a very successful scientist if he had filled up a notebook like this, complete with facts, such as apple A was red and it fell from a tree 15 feet high in X seconds, and apple B was green and it fell from the tree 4 feet high in 5 seconds, or whatever. Or the moon revolved around Jupiter in 30 days. Or my pen dropped in 2.5 seconds. That wouldn't have done anything, right? He could have had the best data in the world and he wouldn't have been remembered. Scientists, through creativity, when they go beyond the data and formulate a law that will enable people to predict what will happen. So Newton is famous because he formulated the law I have in the wrong place. Force is proportional to the mass of one object, the mass of another object, divided by the distance squared. Now that's a fantastic, beautiful law because it can predict how the planets will go around the sun, how the moon will go around the planets, and how everything will fall on the planet Earth. So science goes beyond factual data. That means, and it's a corollary, that science is always fallible. It's not giving us just facts, but it goes beyond the facts to interpret and organize them. It says more than the facts. Computers can't do science. It takes a creativity. It's a very creative enterprise. Finally, the fourth characteristic I'd like to talk about is our scientific knowledge is fragmentary and incomplete. Now this is obvious to anybody that's ever had a science class in college. How many of you have ever had a science class in college? Any of you have one? Did they start out, I majored in zoology and chemistry, and it was very discouraging, because every class my professor started out with, everything you're going to learn in this class will be outdated before you graduate. Do you ever get that? It's really rather discouraging. That's why I went into religion. I mean, after all, never mind. And if you haven't had a science course, you know that our knowledge must be fragmentary and incomplete, because you're always hearing scientists tell you how come they need more money for research, right? If they didn't need all that money for research, then, you know, if we knew everything, they wouldn't need all that knowledge. So that means that science is not conclusive, it's infallible. Wow, that's a 40-year slip. Make it fallible and partial and fragmentary. Now, what does this have to do with real concerns that I see between the relationship in science and religion? Well, the first concern relates to the first two. And that's a concern many of you have heard of. Some people call it scientism. Science has helped us so much and do so many spectacular things that people tend to put confidence in it and say that's the only true knowledge is science. Any of you who've ever taught students, all you have to do is come up with scientific data and they're much more impressed than with any other kind of argument. That's the way to convince them. Now, knowledge the science cannot measure is sort of, for many people, seen as pure speculation, as unimportant. Take moral knowledge, for instance. It can't be measured scientifically, and so some people are ethical relativists. You know, you can't prove it by facts, then don't tell me about it. So knowledge, which is very, very important to us, cannot be shown scientifically, and some people may not value it. Let me use one example. Some of you, I think probably all of you, have heard of Masters and Johnson and all their respect on research on sexual activity. Anybody ever read a summary of their stuff? Nobody? A few? Well, it's really very boring because it measures those parts of sexuality that science can measure. And so, you know, they have things like perspiration, heartbeat, redness of complexion, blood pressure, you know, pulse rising, and all these kinds of physiological changes that science can measure. That's what science is good at. Whenever I read that, I always imagine two happily married people laughing at him. And as I imagine them laughing, they're saying to one another, hey, you know, that's true, you do blush. You know, but this has nothing to do with making love. You know, if you want to know, I mean, this is superficial to what we share together, because it doesn't capture the depth, because the emotional, the sharing, the coming together cannot be measured scientifically. Now, if any of you were at the morning session today on technology, what happens in scientism is the same thing that David was saying happens in technology. Those of you that were there, he gave you a sheet and saying there are seven kinds of rules that is followed for good technology, and too often we apply them in other areas. Well, there are certain kinds of limitations in knowledge that's necessary for science. That's why it's so successful. And too often, people act as that's only the significant knowledge. And they may then disvalue other forms of knowledge, moral knowledge, theology, art, poetry. Okay, my second concern relates to characteristics 3 and 4. Science is fragmentary and incomplete. Not only can't it tell us everything that's significant, in fact, large things that are significant it cannot tell us, but it also, the theories it presents are often fragmentary, incomplete, and misleading. Now again, my students are very impressed if I come up with a scientific theory. And it's very sad because they don't realize how often in the past scientific theories have been distorted by prejudice or by incomplete data. And let me give some examples from the past that I think you immediately recognizes fallacious. It's always easier to see something in the past rather than in the future. And I would like to tell you about some articles that were all written in American medical journals at the end of this century and the beginning of the next century. So it would be in the late 1800s and early 1900s, up to about 1930. And at this time, people were applying Darwin's theory of evolution to compare black and white people. And they used it to justify racism. So they misapplied Darwin theory to justify racism. This is in medical journals. You know, this is not in some little time store novel. This is medical journals. Physicians studying the effects of emancipation, the freeing of the slaves, on health concluded almost universally that freedom had caused the mental, moral, and physical deterioration of the black population. They substantiated this argument by citing examples in the comparative anatomy of black and white races. And I will quote from Dr. W.D. English, and the one article I'm quoting from is from the journal Medicine, published in 1896. The other one is the New York Medical Journal, published 1903. This is what Dr. English wrote. A careful inspection reveals in the body of a Negro a mass of minor defects and imperfections from the crown of the head to the soles of the feet. Cranial structures, wide nostril apertures, receding chins, projecting jaws, all type the Negro as the lowest species in Darwinian evolution. That's what he was saying. Now, interest at this time was especially expressed in the sexual nature of blacks. The Negro, doctors explained, possessed an excessive sexual drive, which threatened the very foundation of white society. As one physician noted in the Journal of the American Medical Association, you know, pretty highly respected journal, right? This is from 1914. It's nothing serious, just a bubonic plague. And I quote, "The Negro springs from a southern race, and as such his sexual appetite is strong. All of his environments stimulate this appetite, as does a general rule, his emotional type of religion certainly does not decrease it." Doctors in medical journals were claiming a complete lack of morality on the parts of blacks. One doctor wrote, and I quote again, "Virtue in the Negro race is like angels' visits, few and far in between. In the practice of 16 years, I have never examined a virgin Negro over 14 years of age." End of quote. A particular ominous feature of this overzealous sexuality, doctors argued, was the black man's desire for white women, a perversion from which most races are exempt, wrote Dr. English, prompts the Negro's inclination toward white women, whereas other races incline toward females of their own. Though English estimated the gray matter of the Negro brain to be at least 1,000 years behind that of the white races. Enough? Now, that was scientific theory presented in medical journals, clearly colored by the prejudice of the day. But perhaps it was just scientific hypothesis. We know it's foolish now, but did it do any damage? Well, scientific theories, even incorrect ones, even ones that will later be shown to be false, influence how we act and interact in the world. And this happened too. Because of data like this, in 1932, the U.S. Public Health Service began an experiment on 400 black men in Alabama who had syphilis. The black men were told they were getting treatment, but they received no treatment because the doctors wanted to see how the disease would progress. They were told. Now, it was justified because science has shown that they couldn't follow through with the treatment anyway, and if they were cured of the disease, they'd get it again because they were so promiscuous. You know, that was the justification. The blacks received no treatment until the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare stopped the experiment. Anybody want to guess the year it was stopped? Started in 32, when do you think it was stopped? They were lied to, they were told they're getting treatment. In the 40s, you think? Try 1972. 40 years after the experiment was began, 20 years after penicillin had proved an effective treatment for syphilis. Aren't there some lawsuits or something like that? I don't know. It could. What? I imagine. When it was stopped, 74 of the original 400 men were alive. only 74. How many died of syphilis is not clear, perhaps 28, at least 28, perhaps more than 100. Now, there are many examples where where scientists have fostered certain kinds of things. In the French hospitals in Paris, a very famous school, right again at the turn of the century, got a lot of very good scientific data weighing brain sizes. Got to weigh brain sizes, right? And the data is collected very, very well. You know, contemporary scientists look at it and say, it's good data collection. And the person that was in charge of this, Paul Brockle, presented himself as an apostle of objectivity. He said he wanted to be governed only by facts, casting aside all superstition and sentimentality. Objective data must govern the results. Facts are facts. We cannot let sentimentality interfere. You've heard that line? So he collected his data. And he did autopsies on men and women who had died from four hospitals. And he weighed the brains of 292 males and found that they averaged 1,325 grams. He weighed the brains of 140 females and found that they averaged 1,144 grams, 14% smaller than the men's. Obviously, he concluded objectively, scientifically, non-prejudicial, that women's brains were smaller than men, therefore women were inferior in intelligence. One of the members of his school, Gustave Le Bon, wrote the following, and this is published, again, not in, the one you get in the supermarkets. This was published in the leading French anthropological journal. In the most intelligent races, as among the Frenchmen, there are objective data now, folks. In the most intelligent races, as among the Frenchmen, there are a number of women whose brains are closer in size to those of gorillas than to the most developed male brains. This inferiority is so obvious that no one can contest it for a moment. Only its degree is worth discussing. All psychologists who have studied the intelligence of women, as well as poets and novelists, recognize today that they represent the most inferior forms of human evolution, and that they are closer to children and savages than to an adult civilized man. They excel in fickleness, absence of logic and thought, and incapacity to reason. Without doubt, there exist some distinguished women, very superior to the average man, but they are as exceptional as the birth of any monstrosity. As for an example of a gorilla with two heads. Consequently, we may neglect them entirely, so we don't have to include them in our data. Now, part of his problem was, in these theories, that there are other relevant factors that influence brain size, you know, other than male-femaleness. Height, the taller you are, probably the larger brain size. Age, the men happen to be young, the women he did autopsies on happen to be older, quite a bit older. And your brain weight will decrease as you get older. Body shape may have something to do with the debilitating diseases. But that's beside the point. He did this beautiful theory because he assumed that you can correlate brain size to intelligence. Now, all of you here, do you really think that taller men are more intelligent than shorter men?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Some of you do. Now, as you might guess, after applying this to women, who do you think they applied it to next? Lo and behold, they found out that men of the black races have a brain scarcely heavier than that of white women. So it is used to justify racism. Now you'd think we might have learned something, you know, our lesson from the last century in America. Because at that time, you know, we just rediscovered Mendel's genetics. And genetics is one of the fields where this is most apt to happen. And Mendel's work was done, Mendel, by the way, was an Augustinian monk who did his work with pea pods from 1858 to 1865. And he tried to test for 21 features in pea pods, and factors such as texture, color of pod, and height of the plants. So he had 21 of them. And each one was on one gene site. It could be dominant or recessive, but if it was dominant, it was controlled by one gene, recessive by two. But it'd be, you know, if we had a chromosome all marked up, they would be both on one gene site. Well, nobody paid any attention to his work when he published it, but it was rediscovered in 1900. And by early in the 1900s, people made a generalization, right? Using their heads, and they say, because one pair in peas, is responsible for one characteristic, at least the 21 very carefully selected characteristics Mendel tested for, and everybody thinks he did a lot of experiments before he got his ideal results, you know, because he just had it perfect. Therefore, that must apply also to human beings. And so early in the 1900s in America, people thought there was one gene that was responsible for each of the following characteristics. One gene: skull shape, stature, eye color, hair color, nose shape, tuberculosis, being an imbecile, having syphilis, being insane, being a prostitute, being an alcoholic, and having pellagra, which is a vitamin B deficiency disease. Again, they're wrong. So what? They're wrong, right? Well, this was the best theory available. People didn't recognize it was incomplete, so it started being applied. One place it made its appearance was in the American Life Insurance Medical Directors Dictionary on how you can deny people life insurance or charge them greater, higher rates. All these things were listed as genetic diseases. That meant if I was an alcoholic and I had a kid, they could deny my kid insurance, because one gene for alcoholism, my kid. And it was listed then in the official directory until 1950. Well, if we have one gene that's responsible for all these things, like prostitution, alcoholism, or something like that, the best way to get rid of them is sterilization, right? And in 1907, Indiana became the first state to enact a sterilization law. By 1935, 20 states had eugenic sterilization laws to improve the gene pool. It was a test case in the Supreme Court, and it was their laws were declared constitutional. In 1913, H.E. Walker called for a eugenic consciousness in America. And what he was particularly was concerned about were the immigrants coming over. And he thought they would corrupt our gene pool. And so his evidence was in 1908, he said, in Ellis Island alone, there were 65 idiots, 121 feeble-minded people, 184 insane people, 3,741 paupers, evidently that's genetic too, 2,900 people with contagious diseases, 53 people with TB, 136 criminals, and 124 prostitutes. The knowledge was applied. Early in 1920s, the U.S. Congress passed the Johnson Act, which limited immigration. This is bad genetics. In genetics, if you look, there are very few traits, and this is a 1978 catalog, could list only 2,811 traits that would be on single genes. You know, either autosomal recessive, autosomal dominant, or sex-linked. That's very minor. The vast majority of them are multifactorial, caused by many gene sites, something like intelligence. Also, there's a great interaction between genes and environment. For instance, if I had not had adequate food, suffered from malnutrition between my first and my fourth year of, from the time I was a baby to the time I was four, I could have suffered as much as 25% a decrease in my intelligence. So clearly there's no one simple gene for intelligence. Some people are even getting taller as the diets change. You know, you see this in certain races of people, their diet changes. diabetes, mental neural tube disorders, congenital heart malformations, hypertension, clubfoot. All of these are multifactorial problems. You heard of spina bifida? That's a very, very serious disease, often when an identical twin. So at birth, one will have spinal bifida and one will not, because it's environmental factors already, even in the womb. Oh, you'd think we'd learn. Well, I don't think we have. I think we still tend to latch on to a scientific theory that's temporary hypothesis and just sort of latch on to it and allow and treat it as fact.